presentation of the medals. And it gives me great pleasure to introduce to you Miss Elizabeth Burr, the chairman of the Newberry Caldecott Committee, vice president and president-elect of the Children's Services Division of the American Library Association, who will present the Newberry and the Caldecott Awards. Miss Burr.
Andy Rush, Jr. had a lot of friends in Serenity, the town where he lived. But his best friend was Onion John. And for a time, Onion John was his very bestest friend. The book that we honor tonight is named for this best friend of Andy's. And it has been chosen as the most distinguished contribution to American literature for children published in 1959. By decision of the Children's Services Division, and for the first time since Frederick G. Melcher bestowed upon us the Newbery Medal, it goes to an author who has received it previously. And now it is with the greatest pride that I present to the author of Onion John and to you, Joseph Crumgold, the Newbery Medal of 1960.
Your Excellency, ladies and gentlemen, surely the most useful, the most proper way for me to accept this honor here tonight is to offer you the one report that by your bounty I'm uniquely qualified to furnish you. This is the first time that you've put anyone up here who was able to tell you how it feels not only to accept the Newbery Medal, but how to go away, but how it feels to go away and live with the distinction once these tables are cleared. And so I propose to give you a clinical record of that somewhat disturbing experience. To begin with, prior to this meeting, the lucky author suffers a steady loss of virtue. The months that lead from February, when the award is a secret, until June, when it gets to be an excellent dinner, becomes for the writer a personal calendar of mortal sin. To be sure, at the first news, there is a moment of humility, a sense of being unworthy of a reward this great. But that moment passes very quickly. And pride takes its place, an overweening and continuous pride. Physically, I've found this state to be an inward pressure resembling an old-fashioned case of dyspepsia. And the only way to live with it, to keep it down, is to develop an even greater vice, a smugness that covers one's swelling importance with a general air of contented superiority. And when this grand manner is challenged, or worse yet, when it's not even noticed, then the descent down the moral ladder continues and an arrogance develops. Until I, for one, don't know how any wife or any publisher manages to live with an author during the spring that you invite him here. It's not your fault, of course. It seems to be a fairly widespread piece of irony that good fortune, more often than not, impairs the personality. Whereas disaster, any good catastrophe, calls out all the virtues. Find a decent fire, or even the smallest war, and there will be self-denial, courage, kinship, and heroism in great plenty. Even martyrdom, if things only get bad enough, and sainthood. It's ironic, is all I want to say. I'm not suggesting that you bring your authors to torture here instead of to a banquet table. The fact is that for any writer trained to perform in solitude, standing up to a room this large, filled with this many people, is rough enough. The first time through, I thought this was going to be the hardest part. I return to tell you that it isn't. The worst part comes afterwards. After the sinful calendar of these springtime months are over, and after all the congratulations and goodbyes were spoken here, the worst time comes when the writer returns to that still and familiar room where there's a typewriter, the place where he works. Usually, there are two people present in this room. The work that's done here must interest a reader for the 4 or 5 hours it takes him to go through a book, and it must interest a writer for the 4 or 5 months, sometimes more, that it will take him to write it. In this room, it's a delicate duet that's played between these two, and frequently it's a very melodious one. But when the writer returns with his medal, he finds another presence there in the quiet, and it's you people. The memory of this hall stays very much alive, except that it turns into sort of a surgical operating theater, with all of you seated in narrowing circles that lead down to the spotlight under which the author sits staring at his typewriter. And to the two questions he must ask of the last sentence on his paper, a third is added. Not only is this amusing to read, not only is this valid enough to work on, but a third question all of a sudden, is this literature? The question can't be avoided. The one sure point of these proceedings is that the author has contributed to a literature. That's what he's done. And though the heavens fall, as long as he's able to type, that's what he's committed to keep on doing, turning out literature. Well, whatever literature might be, and I'm sure this assembly could spend the rest of the night defining it, it doesn't get done by finishing your last breakfast cup of coffee and going into your room to light a cigarette and rip some of the stuff off. You can't put in a day's work at it. And if you try, you can't put in a day's work at much else. The normal dialogue between a writer and a reader is delicate enough to keep going. Once the question is asked whether all this talk going on has any cultural value, the whole thing stutters to a stop. The sentence gets penciled, the paragraph shifted, and again to meet this new abstract requirement of literature, the chapter gets revised and replotted and redrafted and rewritten, the problem can get desperate. Until you begin to wonder about the Newbery Medal and the worth of it as a piece of equipment up there on the shelf in your workroom. At least that's the way it happened to me. And I'm glad to report that I personally was lucky, simply because the book I was working on, Onion John, had to deal with this very problem. Curiously, I was writing about two characters who found themselves overwhelmed, as I was, by a substantial gift. We were all three of us concerned with our role as recipient. Andy, the boy, was, of course, in the worst fix of all. Simply as a youngster, he was one of that part of us who are forever the recipient. It's our children, after all, to whom we eternally give our best for what's good for them. There's always the question of utility, to be sure that these gifts will turn out to be useful for us as well. But there's no denying our good intention, that we want them to have whatever's going much better than we did. Well, there we were. Andy was being given an abstract future he didn't know anything about. Onion John was being dragged out of a meaningful past into a mechanical present that he didn't know anything about. And I had the honor of carrying on a literature, the more I rewrote and revised, that I got to know less and less about. We considered the matter, the three of us, and we came to a common conclusion. Each one of us rejected our gifts. Onion John ran away. Andy finally spoke his mind to his father. And I took the Newbery Medal from the quiet, grown desperate of the room where I worked, and I put it outside my working day. I got rid of it. And there, as a functioning writer, was the effective and final act of my accepting that medal. Because when this was done, I was indeed able to go to work. Only then did the familiar dialogue return between me and my reader. And soon even my reader was forgotten, and the only presence in that room was Andy Rush Jr. and Onion John and myself, the three of us, working our way to an end. And curiously again, we came to a common end, as it turned out. We three discovered that whosoever presents us with a gift must wholly accept and return whatever it is we have to offer. Andy gave his father not the rational cooperation that was expected, but the only small present that a child can make to a human being: his own deep love, his devotion, and the admiration he feels. And it was accepted. And once this was done, Onion John could come back. It was safe for him again. The boy no longer had any need to misuse him for a refuge, nor did the father to use him for a tool. And Onion John could send back over the town of Serenity again the smoke of his oak fire, and along with it, the mystery and the wonder that that this oversized image of a child brought to the people of the town. I'm sure it was accepted. For what town from the city of Hamlin down to our own day can get along without these gifts that our children bring us? And I got the book done. And with the whole esoteric concern with literature placed to one side, I find that it too, to my astonishment, is accepted. And so I thank you. Because now I know how. I've had a new look through the writing of this book at the Newbery Medal. I find the one that it places under commitment is not me, but you. The writer can bring you only what he's able. You assure him that however personal a job he does, however indifferent it is to the market and to the demand, that if it's truly done, it will be read. You give yourself a hard job. Surely, there must be a great variety of publications that would be simpler to get into a child's hands than the books you honor here. But I think that if this simpler way were taken, a very great deal might be lost. A long line of the oldest kind of books, I'm afraid, would come to an end. These are family books that I'm talking about. Starting with the Bible, they were books to be read as they were surely written at many levels. Our bestsellers today are not that useful. Lolita and Peyton Place don't get sent up to the nursery after they're entertained in the parlor. And if the family gets together for its entertainment at all, it's not around a book, but in front of the television set or at a drive-in movie. Not that I have anything against these mass media. They happen to be my own primary professional concern. They simply cost too much, that's all, for a person to use as a personal way of talking. And it's the book that remains the one place where a man can speak and get listened to most purely, most responsibly, without inhibition, directly, where we meet the most interesting people at their most honest is surely in the library. And except for those who are classically established, we rarely meet them anymore in each other's company as a family. It wouldn't happen at all unless it were for you. And the extraordinary value of an adult and a child sharing a common meeting with a book that's new to them both, a book equally rich and meaningful to them both, an adventure that might lead them both to a better understanding of each other, all that might forever be lost, unless it were for you. Because the books you do seem to pick out here have little reference to any specialized audience or narrow popularity. Each one seems to have the chance, at least, of growing old as family books, stories that can be read with great reward at all the different levels that we live. If it were not for your commitment, represented here by the Newbery Medal, the hard job that you've set for yourself, such new books might not get read at all, or worse yet, might not get written. And so as a writer, my most appropriate acceptance is to thank you for the opportunity to write Onion John. And more important, perhaps, as a fellow human being, allow me to say, God bless you.